Hey, it's Francis Lam. Thanks so much for downloading this week's podcast. And if you ever want more info on anything you hear on our show, you can always find it at splendidtable.org. Recipes, videos, more on our guests, and you can subscribe to our weekly newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. It's all about getting you good things to eat and make on weeknights. But right now, here's this week's podcast, hosted by Lynn Rosetta Casper.
This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rosetta Casper. Here's something for us to ponder. All the water on Earth is here, right now. There's no more coming to the rescue if we mess up. Did you know that every sixth person on the planet can't get safe water? That's 1.1 billion people. Half the people in hospital beds in developing countries are sick because of contaminated water. Well, these facts are what put Anne Bancroft, a schoolteacher turned Arctic explorer, atop a glacier in northern India. With her was a team of six women from six continents. The water trickling out of that ice was the start of India's mother river, the Ganges, a river of worship and sustenance, and sadly, a river of world-class pollution. Anne Bancroft's latest project is Access Water. The goal? To navigate the most important and polluted waterways in the world. To achieve what? Well, to spur awareness and change by connecting with women, farmers, schools, industries, and government. Anne, good to have you back with us.
It's so great to be back.
The project is Access Water. Explain what this is about.
Well, I'll try and do it succinctly. It's a 14-year project. I'm still working with Liv Arneson from Norway. Uh-huh. We've been working together. We're coming into our 18th year.
Uh-huh.
And we have invited six women from six continents to join us, young women who have a passion to do good in the world. And we go from continent to continent every other year on a different waterway, talking to young people and beyond about water all over the world and what we can do to protect and enhance our fresh water around the globe.
So the first trip you did last year was to the Ganges in India.
Yeah.
You were in the Himalayas at the glacier where that river began.
Mm-hmm.
And then you followed that river to its end.
Yeah,
right?
To the sea. You know, this is the Mother Ganga is what they call it. It's the heart of India. So we're up in the Himalayas, and we start at the glacier, as you said, which is receding, and you can see that. You can see the marks on the rock of where that glacier has receded some 3 meters since the 60s. And, you know, that's alarming in and of itself.
Yeah, it is.
And then we drink the water. I never imagined I would ever drink the Ganges when I did all my research for this journey. And then we hike. We're hiking because you can't navigate this in any kind of craft. So we're hiking for the first couple of weeks. And then we get down to a place where it's white water. And we hop in rafts, and we shoot the rapids.
Huh.
We swim in the Ganges, which was incredibly cold and pristine. And then things start to change when the river starts to widen out into the plains. And that's where you start to really see the pollution. The river is very braided. We're right after the monsoon, so we're in November and December, end of October. And we're trying to find the main channel all the time. And so oftentimes we have to get out of our boats and push off of sandbars, which we did not want to do, especially when we could see the squalid water. And, you know, we just continue on this way and we visit villages, schools, universities, industries, all along the river, learning and listening and taking it all in. And the river has many, many personalities.
One of the things that you talk about on the site is how the Ganges has religious meaning to India.
Oh, huge.
And older people do not see that it might be polluted, that you really shouldn't drink the water. Is that the prevalent attitude still, or is that changing?
It's trying to change. It's really difficult because it's bedrocked in religion.
Yeah.
And they believe that the Mother Ganga will replenish itself because rivers tended, you know, without huge stresses of population, they did used to, you know, sort of purify themselves. Yeah. That no longer exists. When economies and population grow, so does our growth of water needs. And, mm-hmm. of course, if you live upriver, you sometimes don't experience what you've done because
it's all going down.
It's down in the next village, perhaps. Yeah. You know, and the monsoons, too, play a role in that because they flush the garbage and the carcasses or whatever it is downriver. And there is that appearance of a cleansing. Young people are trying to make changes. They're getting educated. They're paying attention. They're tapped in to the rest of the world for the same reasons we are.
Mm-hmm. I think of water. And in so much of the world, water and women are inseparable. They're the ones who do the hauling. They're the ones who have to get the water so they can cook and they can clean and do whatever is necessary with the water. I gather this is true in India.
It is pretty true in India, and it's true all over the world. It's why we selected an all-women's team to really call attention to some of those issues around gender and roles. And girls, for instance, not staying in school because of lack of water and sanitary conditions when they get to adolescence, for instance. So we want to talk about those things that intersect. And that's the lovely part about, you know, water being this huge umbrella of a topic. When we were on the river, when you would pull to the shore, the women would hang back, however. In this society, it's very male-dominated. We utilized our power as foreign women, and it took us some time to learn that we had this power to suggest that we would like to visit with the women as well. And if we requested it, we could sort of break those rules gently because we were different.
Were the women receptive?
Very receptive. They're very shy, very anxious to talk when no men were around.
So do you think change is going to come about? What is the aftermath of something like this?
Well, it happens in lots of different ways. And really, we are about engagement. I think, you know, there's several examples. One was when we were having a discussion and there were some politicians and some business leaders brought before us to show us about what they were doing in their community. They were in a big city, but they were a very economically poor suburb.
Mm-hmm.
But they were trying to pick up trash and had these small initiatives. And when we departed, they said, if you came so far to travel our river and to care about our river and to try and understand the issues, both good and bad, around our river, we too should care. And when we hopped in our boats and said goodbye, and I have this photograph, it's giving me chills, the entire village is along the shoreline, and they're waving goodbye to us after we've had this emotional, wonderful day, these warm people who have fed us and embraced us and knew nothing of us. This wasn't planned.
Mm-hmm.
And then they yelled out, the ones who could speak English, post this on Facebook. And I just thought, you know, this is really what it's about. It doesn't always have to be, you know, these really complex initiatives. We have tremendous power as individual citizens.
Quite a project. And thanks so much for this.
Thanks for having me.
Explorer Anne Bancroft's project is Access Water. Their next waterway is the mighty Mississippi in 2018. Take a look at the trek Anne and her team made down the Ganges. You can find the video at splendidtable.org. Jekka McVicker is the UK's herb queen. Her nursery produces over 300 herbs, and her knowledge of them could fill several volumes. Jekka has a slightly mischievous edge. She loves to come up with the unexpected. Jacka, welcome back.
Thank you. It's so lovely to be back.
I'd like to talk to you about celery leaves. No one thinks of celery leaves as an herb.
No. Well, the Latin is apium graveolens. Now, are you sitting comfortably?
I am very comfortable. Yes.
Good. Right. Here goes. Every war, the people have taken their herbs with them. So when the Romans invaded the UK, they brought over 700 herbs with them.
Oh.
And celery leaf, Apium graveolens, is a UK native herb. It used to grow wild. And when we trotted off to India to war, we took celery leaf with us. So the leaf and the seed is now used in Indian cooking. And this shows how herbs travel around the world.
Ah.
And in France, celery leaf is called persil. And it looks just like French parsley. And what's happened is the growers have bred your celery sticks that you have.
Yeah, the celery sticks.
And
stuff,
they're
yeah.
really tough, and I don't like that. But if you get the seed for celery leaf, it'll look like French parsley, but it'll taste just like celery, and it is gorgeous. You know, it really is. It transforms a salad. Just add it to mashed potato. Yeah, it's just fantastic. But for me, the seed, the celery seed, I let it go to flower. And that seed, you can make celery salt. And great Christmas present, you just buy the salt, dry the seeds, whack them together, and give it to your girlfriends, because that is so good to cook with.
Yeah.
Adding it to soups and things. But personally, I'm getting on in age now, and I've been in horticulture over 35 years. So I have potted a lot of plants with my hands. So I've got arthritis in my hands now.
Mm-hmm.
And when it's really bad on damp days like today, I drink celery seed tea. And I just put a teaspoon of seed into a cup. I add boiled water, and that helps my joints and really takes away the pain. It's fantastic. However, this is the first one I'm giving you a warning.
Yeah.
Please, if any of you are allergic to peanuts, do not drink celery seed tea. You can eat the leaf by all means. You won't have any reaction, but you can to the seed.
Huh. Now, if I want to use the tops of the celery stalks.
Yes, absolutely.
Uh-huh.
It's fantastic. It'll be slightly tougher than what I grow
right.
as celery leaf. But absolutely. And use it in soups. You know, I mean, don't waste it. It's great.
I love it because I think you cannot make a really good tasting broth, chicken broth or whatever,
yeah.
without those leaves.
So right. Brilliant.
This, I'm just making a note to myself because I never realized there was that plant that was really about the leaf. Thank you for this insight. We're not going to look at a stalk of celery quite the same way. Jacka,
thank
you. Many thanks.
Thank you.
Jacka McVicker is the author of Jacka's Herb Cookbook. Australia's Donna Hay left us with a recipe a while back for a great salad. Find her celery and apple salad at splendidtable.org. Coming up, an old-fashioned and a relish tray, anybody? It's the cult of the Wisconsin Supper Club. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. London caterer Sabrina Gayor's first cookbook, Persiana, was about Middle Eastern-inspired food from her popular supper club. It was a smash hit. Now, she's followed that book up with Shirako, a collection of recipes that she says are based not on the dressed-up dinner party food, but on what she really cooks at home. A Goal Hour contributor, journalist, and cook, Russ Parsons, wholeheartedly embraces.
Sabrina Gayor, thank you for taking time to talk to me.
Thank you so much for having me.
Your cookbooks are informed by the flavors of the Middle East, but they're not traditionally Middle Eastern. And that's especially true, I think, with Sirocco as opposed to Persiana. First of all, there's been so much, so much bad fusion cooking. Maybe that's just here in the United States. It's kind of, it almost makes people quiver. But yours works. How do you make yours work? And how do you keep both the tradition and the flavors that you're looking for in mind while still pushing it forward into different techniques and making it more accessible?
You know, the simple truth is, Ross, I'm a total nerd when it comes to cooking. I cook every day, three times a day if I'm at home, sometimes more than that, depending on what I'm doing. I've always done what felt good to me, and the food that ends up going into my book, for example, with Persiana, happened to be simplified versions of Middle Eastern recipes because I was self-taught. I needed to simplify it. But, you know, the great thing was that because I had, Persian family from Iraq, family from all over the place, I had the exposure to know what things do taste like when they're made authentically. But then I kind of cut out all the, 6 hours for this and 5 hours for that, because I just thought people are never going to cook the food of my culture. It's going to die because none of my generation and my family cook. But Sirocco is strictly what I eat at home. I am somebody that kind of throws open the pantry and the spice cupboards and just throws whatever I can at whatever fresh produce I have. But the one thing being that when I write a recipe, my line is this. If it's, yeah, that's nice, it doesn't make it into the book. If it's like, oh my God, that's so good, then it makes it into the book. I want simple recipes that are really intense in flavor, not complicated, not expensive, and just incredibly easy to do.
Well, as you said, that traditional Middle Eastern, traditional Persian cooking is very labor intensive. But in your book, you call yourself a lazy cook who's always looking for shortcut techniques. What are some of your favorite shortcuts?
So with Persiana, that's where I really took the shortcuts, because Sirocco only has really a couple of quite Persian dishes in there. But Persiana, yeah, there's some controversial shortcut techniques. What I did to rice, that took a while for the Persian community to digest. And they kept sort of chasing me going, you know, we don't cook rice like that. I'm like, I know, geez, but nobody's gonna make the 6 hour version. And I just realized that the reason rice was soaked and washed and soaked and washed for so long is because, in Iran back in the day, rice wasn't commercially washed. So it had husks, it had stones, it has impurities. Now for export, every country demands that it meets a standard. So it's actually clean. So therefore, you can actually cut out those processes should you choose to. Is it ever going to be as good as the 6 hour soaked rice that you rinse and drain and rinse and, no, it's probably not. But it's only just a fraction, sort of less good, in my opinion. And I've got people from all over the world that are not Persian making it. And it makes me proud, because maybe they wouldn't without that little cheats technique. So that's one thing. Stews. Persians love to use 10 different pots and pans. And when I'm in the home, if there's a shortcut, I will take it. And I hate dirtying like loads and loads of different pots and pans. It's just a mess. So I tend to contain everything within a pot. And when I started writing different recipes and putting them up on my blog, I'd have all my aunts from all over the world going, we don't do that. And you can't do it like this. And you have to do it in a separate pan. And I would be like, okay, but like, just try it. And then they come back to me and go, oh my God, I can't believe it. I can't believe it worked. And I was like, yeah, so just toss it all in and it will be fine. So, I kind of just did it however I thought it was, and it worked.
The flavors in your recipes are so dynamic. What do you consider the essential Middle Eastern toolkit of ingredients? Spices, herbs, other flavors?
Sure. So I'm obsessed with harissa, which is a North African chili paste. I love pomegranate molasses, which is just 100% reduced pomegranate juice. I love sumac, which is just a little tart berry that is ground down and has a very nice lemon flavor. I love za'atar, which is just basically means wild thyme. It's wonderful. And then I like what you guys call Aleppo pepper, but it's a Turkish chili flake called pul biber over here. It's a milder chili flake, and it doesn't have the seeds, so it's not as fiery. And I put it on everything. So, I mean, those. But quite frankly, you can't get harissa. Just use chili paste. It's the same thing, but it's just a little bit more fiery. Ultimately, there's nothing that cannot be either made at home or replaced with something else, because that's just not how I cook. I don't write hard and fast rules for things. There's always a substitute for everything. Preserved lemons, you can make at home. It's just salt-packed lemons, and you can just Google, you know, a recipe. These are ancient traditions, so it's not particularly difficult to find. Pomegranate molasses, from what I understand, that's now everywhere in the States. And if not, get some pomegranate juice and just reduce it in a pan. Maybe za'atar is a little trickier because it's wild thyme, but just use regular thyme. Grind it down to a powder if you don't have wild thyme. And I just think those are what I use again and again and again, along with the zest of lemons and the zest of oranges, to really give things, you know, big flavors, but just really effortlessly.
Oh, that's wonderful. Sabrina Gayoor, thank you so much for having been on Splendid Table with me and taking time to talk.
Thank you so much for having me, Russ.
Sabrina Gayoor is author of Shirako, Fabulous Flavors from the Middle East. Russ Parsons is author of How to Pick a Peach. Now, Sabrina left us with recipes for quince-glazed chicken skewers and grape-leaf-baked feta. And you can find them at splendidtable.org. Now, you'll also find this week's video there. Look for an interview with Leanne Brown, the masterful mind behind Good and Cheap. Eat well on $4 a day. And it's all there, splendidtable.org. I have finally gotten my wish. The Midwest is no longer flyover country when it comes to good eating. And yeah, the new places can be sensational, but the golden old traditional places are getting new respect. They capture that sense of community. In fact, there's a word for it, Gemütlichkeit. It's a German word referring to the warmth and good cheer of coming together over great food and drink. That spirit led to the legendary supper clubs of Wisconsin decades ago, and their recent comeback. A new documentary tells their stories. It's called Old Fashioned, the story of the Wisconsin Supper Club. Splendid Table contributor Shauna Seaver, a Midwesterner herself, spoke with filmmaker Holly DeRuyter from Chicago.
Hi, Holly. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me here today.
So I have to tell you, I saw the film and I fell in love with it. And I think part of it was because I am born and raised in the Midwest, and I recognized so many of these people and the stories and the snippets of supper club culture. But I have to say, I didn't really realize that supper club culture is a thing, because in the Midwest is so deeply embedded in the fabric of the region that it's almost hard to describe. So I'm going to have you do it. What is a supper club?
Well, a supper club is an independently owned restaurant, usually in a rural location, that's only open for supper. And their menu is very limited. It's mostly surf and turf, and the food is mainly homemade. It's a destination restaurant. You don't go there for a quick bite to eat and leave. You're there for the evening.
Mm.
And the decor usually reflects that of the owners. So, you know, some have some unique Green Bay Packer decor because the owners are Packer fans, and some of them have a log cabin feel to them because they're in the Northwoods.
Right. Now, there was sort of a real growth of supper clubs during a certain point in time. When was that era exactly?
After World War II, so definitely mid-century, the Hobnob in between Kenosha and Racine on Lake Michigan has some great retro, like heavy, rich decor. It's just amazing when you can kind of see the history. And the magic about supper clubs is they keep that. They preserve that, almost like a time capsule.
That's a really great way to describe it. A lot of times in these supper clubs, you feel like you've gone back in time, or you're kind of being enclosed in a way. And it does make it so easy to stay, as you said, for a few hours. Can you explain to us sort of the flow of a meal at a supper club? Because there is sort of a protocol
definitely
for supper club dining.
Well, supper clubs, when you walk in, usually walk into the bar area, and you're not just sitting there and talking with the person or the people that you came with, you're talking with the people around you. supper clubs are all about community and connecting. So you sit at the bar and you have a cocktail or two. And usually a lot of supper clubs, the waitresses will come up and tell you your table number and take your order. But you don't get seated until you ask to be seated.
Oh.
It just feeds into that slow pace. There's no rush. You're never feeling pressure to move on to the next stage of the meal. So once you decide you're ready to go, you tell the bartender, he gets your waitress, they set you down at your table. Usually you have your food already ordered, and when you get to your table, usually a relish tray is waiting for you. And if you ordered soup or salad, that might be there too. A lot of supper clubs are kind of moving away from the relish tray. It's definitely still out there and very strong, but a lot of them have moved over to salad bars just to cut down on food waste.
Oh, interesting. Mm-hmm. Because what would traditionally be in the relish tray?
The relish tray is generally made out of like fresh vegetables, so like celery and carrots and radish, but then there's also cheese spreads on there. Mm. A lot of times one might be like homemade in-house, liver pate. They also have different kinds of pickled items, so pickled beets and pickled asparagus. It really depends on the season and what that supper club specializes in, because a lot of these supper clubs have recipes that have been handed down generation to generation. So they might be known for their pickled herring or their creamy cucumber salad.
And then when you're talking about main dishes at a supper club, give us an example of some of those.
The supper club menu is very limited. It usually focuses on the surf and turf menu. Mm-hmm. So a lot of fish, a lot of different steaks, but a lot of supper clubs are kind of adding lighter fare or some more modern twists.
And then the dessert menu I noticed is very limited as well. Mm-hmm. A cheesecake or maybe a slice of pie. And mm-hmm. it's interesting because when you're talking about the limited menu, it does reflect a sense of sort of local eating. And it's not about, you know, having a million different options. It's really about having food that's from that specific area, and it's top quality.
Mm-hmm, definitely. But also the flow of the supper club evening, when you get done eating, again, at no rush, you can leave, or the more common decision is to return to the bar. And what naturally goes with that is having an ice cream drink at the bar. That, I would say, is like the number one choice with desserts at supper club, is to have an ice cream drink. And Grasshopper and Brandy Alexander, I would say, are the top choices.
So it's like a boozy milkshake?
Pretty much. It's a good way to describe
it. All right.
It's very low in alcohol, but they're really good. My favorite is the Pink Squirrel, and that's an almond-flavored ice cream drink. It was actually invented in Milwaukee at a bar.
So something that a lot of people will do, I mean, in modern times, going out to dinner, is you want to go somewhere for a nightcap. But you're saying that here in the supper club, you want to keep it all in one spot, and it's about coming back to the bar as a sense of community.
Oh, yes. It's so funny. In today's world, we're all like, we're going to go here for dinner, we're going to go here for entertainment. And the supper club, it used to be, it embodied everything. Live entertainment was a huge thing in the supper club in its early history. But when they had to tighten their budget and much their money more, entertainment was something that got cut. Mm. So you don't see it that much, but there's definitely supper clubs out there that still have their dance floor and have little platform for the live entertainment, and that really makes for an amazing night out with the dinner and dancing.
That sounds so fun. So you start at the bar, you end at the bar. The bar is obviously a really important part of it.
Yes.
Tell us about the old fashioned, because that is the signature cocktail of the supper club, right?
Oh, most definitely. The old fashioned, well, the brandy old fashioned is a solid Wisconsin drink.
Mm-hmm.
It has its origins from the Prohibition era, when, you know, people couldn't really be too picky about their liquor choices. And some of the stuff being made wasn't the best. So they started sugaring and adding soda and fruit to their cocktails. So that's kind of how the modern day brandy old fashioned came to be. You know, it's got the bitters, the sugar, and it's got a cherry and orange in it, and then the brandy and the soda.
The alcohol is quite a bit better now than it was back then.
But the brandy component was a unique thing. Korbel started making brandy, brought it to the Chicago World's Fair. A lot of Germans from Wisconsin came down and they discovered this new, pretty affordable type of brandy. So they started mixing their old fashions with it. So that's how the brand became so big in Wisconsin.
And a lot of it stems from that supper club culture, which is still alive. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because when you watch the film, you really do get a sense that there was a time where supper clubs are starting to slow down. And as you're watching the film, you start to worry, is this becoming a dying art in a way, you know, and you're cheering for these restaurants because it's such a wonderful experience. But what's happened in the past couple of years, it really is starting to come back.
Yeah, there's this renewed interest, which is great. I'm really excited to see that.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for talking with us, Holly.
Thanks.
Holly DeRuyter is director, editor, and producer of Old Fashioned, the story of the Wisconsin Supper Club. Shauna Seaver's latest book is Real Sweet. Now serve your own supper club feast with this master recipe from J. Kenji Lopez Alt for butter-basted, pan-seared, thick steaks. Find it at splendidtable.org. Coming up, more of your calls and America's Test Kitchen's latest discovery. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. It's time to turn to your calls, so let's connect any way we can. Facebook, Twitter, or pick up the phone. 800-537-5252. Gail from Farmington, New Mexico is calling us. Gail, hi, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Oh, hi, Lynn. I have a tree full of, actually two trees full of apricots right outside my window. And they are beautiful. They have such a beautiful blush on them, and they are ready to be harvested. And I, there are so many of them. There's just hundreds. I don't know what to do with them.
Oh, it's that time of year, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
A quick question, though. Is Farmington up in the mountains?
We're desert. We're in the Four Corners area.
Oh, yeah.
Arizona, Utah, and Colorado and New Mexico meet. And if you go 45 minutes to the north, you're in Colorado, and then it's mountains. But
right.
We're about a mile above sea level, but it's very arid and dry here. But in Farmington, we have three rivers here, and so it's been a farming community for many, many years.
Hence the name.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So two trees full of apricots. Well, let's see now. Okay, the first thing that occurs to me is, of course, you know, you can do jam, and you can take any jam recipe and turn it into something that's sort of sweet and savory by adding some vinegar, adding things like garlic and onion and spices. Uh-huh. And, of course, you're in chili country. Chilies would be
right.
Wonderful. So that's one thing you can do. Just take that basic recipe and turn it into what you might call...
like a chutney?
Well,
a chutney?
Essentially, yeah. There's another name for it, but it'll come to me tomorrow at about 9 in the morning.
Of course.
The other thing I keep thinking about, I mean, obviously eating it fresh and freezing them. But one of the things that might be really wonderful to do is to roast a whole bunch of them. Take some large sheet pans, cut them in half, you know, pit them. And then what you can do is put a little olive oil on the sheet pan or any kind of oil. It's flavorless is probably better. And put them cut side up. Don't let them touch. And then dot them with either butter or something like an almond oil if you can get it. Because it has a lovely flavor. You just want a little bit of some kind of fat. And then sprinkle them with sugar. Brown sugar would be wonderful. And then think about flavoring. Cinnamon is obvious, but allspice is amazing with stone fruits. And you don't see it used very much. And just a touch of clove. And you can mix that together. And a little black pepper Really nice touch.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And by the way, this is also a place where a little bit of your ground red chili, a very tiny amount, you want it just as a subtle backdrop. It'll heighten the fruit. So you do all of that, and then you slow roast it, 200 degrees perhaps, and let them roast really slowly so they're drying a bit. They're still moist, but they're caramelized. And at that point, you could either freeze them. And one of the best ways to do that is take a piece of foil or wax paper, put it over cookie sheets, and then just space them and put them in a freezer and let them really freeze. And then you can pop all of those into plastic bags. And you pull them out when you want to use them, and they'd be wonderful for dessert. You could serve them with meats. You could warm them up and have them beside something like a really luscious pie, especially in the winter. So you can use them in a ton of ways. You can go with savory, and you can go with sweet.
Oh, that sounds wonderful, Lynn. Thank you so much. It's making my mouth water.
The other thing, by the way, is pureeing. Now, if you puree the apricots with a bit of lemon juice, a little bit of lemon rind, and if you need sugar, do sugar to taste, all right? Right away, you have the beginning of a filling or a sauce. And once again, you can freeze them and you can pull them out when you want to make a cheesecake, when you want to do a simple tart, when you want to just spread them on a bagel, for goodness sakes. So you have not a super sweet, fresh jam. And the lemon gives it a little bit of an edge.
Oh, yes. And it preserves it a bit, too. So that's nice,
yeah.
too.
Yeah. And you're not having to cook it a long time. You're not using a lot of sweetener. It's really as fresh as you're going to be able to get it and use it wherever. You could spread that on something like a ham sandwich or something that's been barbecued or smoked. It's a fabulous thing to use with sandwiches and that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So you may need more trees.
I don't know. I have hundreds and hundreds. I mean, just with these two trees, we had a bumper crop of apricots all over New Mexico this year. And everybody is trying to do something with their apricots.
Could be worse. Hey, Gail,
yeah,
thanks for calling.
Thank you so much, Lynn. Oh, thank you. I'm thrilled. Thank you very much.
You are welcome. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
By the way, that idea of fresh fruit, especially stone fruit, I mean, let's face it. Apricots, nectarines, peaches of all sorts. It's just, and plums too. Take them and literally just puree them. Add some form of acid, orange juice, lemon juice, lime juice, just a bit, and then balance that with a bit of sugar to taste. And then freeze it. And it shouldn't darken. And what happens is you have a jam, you have a spread, and just like the slow roasted apricots, which you can do with any stone fruit, you have something that can go with, you know, savory things or go to the end of the meal with sweets. And it's easy. You don't have to have the pot on the stove and all of that. Anyway, call us, 800-537-5252. Sonia has done just that, and she's in Watsonville, California. Sonia, hi. What's on your mind? What do you want to talk about?
Hello, Lynn. I'm recently returned from Ecuador, where, among other wonderful things, I toured a chocolate plantation.
Oh, you poor soul.
Yes. We had a delightful tour, seeing how things grow, and the process of making chocolate. And, of course, we sampled lots of chocolate. And we got very greedy, and we brought home 1 kilo in a brick form.
2.2 pounds of chocolate. I like the way you think.
Yes. So here it sits. And every once in a while, I've opened it up and luxuriated in the smell.
Mm.
And I've tried to cut some off to make some things.
Yeah.
And it doesn't cut. It's extremely difficult. I thought, maybe a wire or a cleaver.
Yeah.
But it's a very solid brick. So I want to know from you some of the things I can do with this chocolate. It's so special, I don't want to ruin it.
tell me what it tastes like.
Well, it is semi-sweet. It's been sweetened.
Mm-hmm.
It has ingredients that include liquor, cacao.
Right.
Azúcar, sugar.
Right.
Butter of cocoa.
Right. All the right ingredients.
Lactina de soya.
That's a soy lecithin. It's a binder, if I remember. You'll see it in a lot of fine chocolate.
There's also some vanilla in it and emulsificant.
Things to emulsify it, to keep it emulsified and blended.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, okay. This is something where you want to really taste the chocolate. Now, you know, there is the proverbial flourless chocolate cake. There are more recipes for this than, you know, than you can imagine. And it's a wonderful way to show off a really fine chocolate. But I'm just wondering...
I am an experienced cook, but I don't do desserts, is what some of my problems are. And people have been sending me recipes. And, of course, some of it is for powdered cocoa, and
right.
Some of it is all different forms, but nothing really says what you do when you have a brick.
Well, you're going to have to divide up that brick. And one of the great ways to break up that kind of thing, just brace yourself for this, is you can lay a paper towel, a couple of layers of paper towel over it, and use a hammer to split it up, to break it up. Now, you'll probably want to be able to weigh it, because most recipes call for ounces of chocolate. And there are very inexpensive scales out there, which is a great idea to have in the kitchen anyway. And what I was thinking was, one of the things we've done in the past, and people get a big kick out of it, is that at the end of the meal, you put out chunks of this chocolate, and then you pick up some other chocolates. So you might look for Valrhona, which is a very fine brand, and you might get some Hershey's, and you might get some Lindt, and, you know, play around with it, Baker's chocolate. And you put them in different dishes. You don't tell people what they are.
I went to a blind test.
And that's ask everybody. And the fun part is, too, if you want to, you could have little pots of whipped cream just so that people, you know, you want to dip, you dip. That sort of thing would be really kind of fun to do. And I think that it would be a great way to feature the chocolate, because the great trick in tasting chocolate is to let it melt on your tongue. And then you see, first of all, you'll get the flavor at the back of your mouth and the front of your mouth. But the other thing is, you'll begin to see, is it very grainy, which means it hasn't been blended a long time. It's called conching. You probably saw it when you were in that chocolate-producing factory, that the more that bean is broken down and whipped, the smoother and silkier, and the silkier melt you get from the chocolate. That's one thing you can do with it. Another thing that would be lovely to do with it, again, not to interfere too much with the flavor, but to bring it out, is to make a wonderful sort of fudge sauce. Melt the chocolate. You would add a bit of coffee to it and a bit of cream. And you essentially add a little bit of those things at a time to get the flavor that you want. And vanilla, of course, which would be wonderful. And there is nothing wrong with a great vanilla ice cream and this hot fudge sauce.
Sounds wonderful. I have some people coming over this weekend, and maybe I can do that.
Give it a try. I think this could be great fun, and it's a natural dip for fruit. And the other great thing about it is the chocolate is the big feature. So it's worth a shot. And I envy you.
Thank you so much.
You are very welcome, and you enjoy your chocolate, Sonia.
Thank you.
Bye. Remember, if you have a question, you can reach out anytime. 800-537-5252. Now, every week, in a joint attempt to help people become more comfortable and successful in their home kitchens, we check in with America's Test Kitchen. This week, managing producer Sally Swift catches up with Lisa McManus. She heads up their equipment testings and ingredient tastings.
Hey, Lisa McManus. Good to have you back.
It's great to be here.
I'm cashing in on my influence here, and I have a question, a personal question for you.
Okay.
I have a friend who is a great baker with a birthday coming up. Do you have any thoughts on like a piece of kind of sneaky, smart, inexpensive equipment I could pick up for him for his birthday?
Well, one of the favorite things that we found, one of the things that I love the best, is portion scoops. These things
what?
Are great. Yeah, right? Like the lunch lady, the dishers. They're just some people think of them as ice cream scoops, but there's so much more.
Tell me how you would use them.
Well, we use them for all kinds of things. Anytime you want something fast and uniform, when you want to scoop out something, generally something fairly soft and difficult to manage, otherwise it gets all sticky and all over everything. So cookie dough, muffin batter, potato salad, ice cream. But then for a smaller size, you can just portion out a whole bunch of cookie dough super fast. They all come out the same size and they bake evenly and they look professional. That's how they do it. That's the secret.
I'd never even thought about that. So what do we look for when buying a portion scoop for a friend?
Well, we tested a whole bunch of them and we really found that some of them are super hard to squeeze. You feel like you're getting way too much hand exercise. It's exhausting and it will wear you out before you get done with the cookie dough. Some of them are too loose and that's actually a problem too. The portion scoop is like a little round scoop with a sliding piece of metal that runs along the back of it as you squeeze and that pushes whatever you scooped up out. And if it doesn't have enough tension, if the little piece of metal doesn't move smoothly, stuff doesn't, it goes in, but it won't come out. Or it comes out and it launches. Or it comes out and it mangles it on the way out.
Right.
There's a lot of ways they can fail. I mean, they all seem very similar, but there's different behaviors when you go to use them. And certain ones you just don't want. They're more work than they save you.
And is there a particular size that would work well if you were going to have one portion scoop in your house?
Well, I think personally, I mean, if you bake a lot of cookies, we looked at that size because we said, you know, that's when people are really doing large batches at the holidays or anytime you bake some cookies, you usually have a couple of dozen that you're working with. And you can really cut that time down and the labor down by great amounts. We did a test where we portioned the same dough with a tablespoon and with a portion scoop, and it took literally a third of the time. So, you know, before you're sick of it, you're done.
I can imagine that testing session with a stopwatch going, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. We timed it. And we also measured and weighed each cookie to see how they came out and whether they were even. And, you know, it's a lot easier to get a uniform cookie with a portion scoop. We found about a 3 tablespoon size is the best size. One of the things you have to look out for, though, is that these are professional tools and they have sort of an unconsumer-friendly way of describing a lot of them. And they'll say it's a number 24 or something. What that means is if you have a level scoop, it will take 24 of those to fill a quart. Well, who can remember that? And who has any idea what that looks like if you're not in the professional baking world? So we looked at about 3 tablespoon size. Our favorite is a 3 tablespoon scoop, which is a great size for cookies. And it's called the OXO Good Grips Large Cookie Scoop. It's $15. It's a nice tension. I have one here.
Wow.
And it just feels great. Well, you can tell. It's kind of fun, right? Just snap, snap, snap. And you can get your baking done really fast. The cookies come out perfect, the same size. They bake evenly. You don't get some that are burning while the other ones aren't done. It's great. And it's our secret weapon.
I think it's a great gift for someone who loves to bake. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Lisa McManus heads up equipment testings and ingredient tastings at America's Test Kitchen. Well, that's it for this week. Francis Lamb is going to be in the host seat next week, so don't miss a chance to talk to him. Find us on Facebook or Twitter or phone it in, 800-537-5252. And in the meantime, let me leave you with this quote from Ogden Nash. He said, "People who work sitting down get paid more than people who work standing up." This summer, Garrison Keillor, along with Heather Massey, Aoife O'Donovan, Rich Dworsky, and the Roadhounds, and Mr. Fred Newman, will be crossing the country with the Prairie Home Love and Comedy Tour. Tickets, locations, info, and more are at prairiehome.org. SplendidTable.org has everything you will ever need.
And if you like what you heard here today, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We've quite an archive of conversations with the people who shape America's food scene. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Courtney McEwen. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thanks for tuning in. You have a great week. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.